Our next speaker is Jeff Schlosch. He's speaking on sociobiological constraints on human nature, theological implications of the altruistic behavior debate. Jeff?
I'm in the biology department at Westmont College, and my area of training is ecology and evolutionary biology, which I studied at Washington University and University of Michigan after an undergraduate degree at Wheaton College. In fact, I should say that, now launching into my talk, that after I'd been at Westmont in the biology department a couple of years, I heard a provocative and bizarre and seldom told story about an incident that occurred between the dean of students and some male undergraduate students before I had arrived. Apparently the dean was dating at the time this incident occurred. He was single, dating one of the young co-eds on campus who was reputed to be one of, if not the most attractive woman on campus. And so a bunch of young men got together and in light of this fact, in celebration or in something else, sent him a present. And the reason I'm sharing this story is because the story itself embodies one of the puzzles and ironies of sociobiology. Here, on the one hand, these guys got together and sent the dean a present, and in so doing, manifested some of the most ennobling characteristics of humankind. They cooperated with one another. They exercised forethought and foresight in devising a plan. They exercised creativity in coming up with an idea of something to send him. They exercised symbolic abstraction and envisioning this guy, even though he wasn't with them. Exercised the ability to manipulate symbolic symbols in writing his address on the box, and exercised the ability to utilize technology and making a box and sending it through the mail. On the other hand, they also exercised another aspect of humanity. You see, when the dean opened the package, what he found was little gifts from each of those people, little discreet piles of human excrement. And I would argue that by that gesture, they also manifested another side of the human personality, a more primal or animalistic side, insofar as they surrendered or capitulated to a kind of hysterical territorialism, a defensive and even aggressive sexual possessiveness, a destructive intergenerational male conflict, and amongst vertebrates at least, rather an inevitable tendency to communicate defiance by the throwing of excrement, common in lots of primates and other vertebrates. So here in microcosm, we have one of the puzzles. In fact, the last paper dealt with it, and puzzles that stun sociobiologists and theologians and anthropologists, and that is to say, what is man? Is he somehow something other than animal altogether? Or in the last analysis, is he only animal? Now, yesterday, Conrad Heyers dealt with that, how Genesis handles that problem, and Heyer suggested to us that Genesis doesn't handle the problem definitively. In Genesis 1, we have this picture of man exalted, man ennobled, man as Lord of the creation and created in the divine image. In Genesis 2, we have a picture, according to Heyer's, of man out of the dust of the earth, one with the animals, not as Lord, but as servant, as caretaker of creation. Similarly, in biology, hundreds of years before Darwin, the deviser of the binomial nomenclature system, Carl Linnaeus, had to settle this problem for himself. Where was he going to put man? Was he going to put man in the same phylogenic tree as the rest of the animals, or is he going to somehow make him wholly other? And again, like Genesis, Linnaeus didn't come down clearly on the issue. In terms of the taxon that he created for man, it was squarely in line with the rest of the animal kingdom. Placed him right in there with the primates. But in terms of the Latin descriptive epithet, which Linnaeus included with all genus and species distinctions, the Latin that Linnaeus used, not as the name Homo sapiens, but as the descriptive epithet, is translated "know thyself." Somehow in that epithet, he suggested that man's uniqueness was, in fact, something wholly other, the capacity for self-knowledge or self-awareness. Now, for some reason, when Linnaeus placed man in the same taxonomic group as in animals, it didn't raise much of a furor, but it did when Darwin did, and it is again now as sociobiologists are making the same suggestion. And in my talk today, I'd like to briefly cover three issues. Number one, a very brief history of why this controversy and disagreement has existed between Christians and Darwinists. Number two, what sociobiology, a sociobiological understanding of the implications for Darwin's theory on understanding human nature, what that has to say to us today and what that theory is. And thirdly, then, what are the ethical and theological implications of sociobiology? Now, I'd like to say first off that as we look at Darwinism, and there's been half a dozen really excellent studies over the last 5 years that have come out specifically on the reception of Darwinism in the 1800s, and many of them specifically on the reception of Darwinism by the church. And they're all pretty much agreed that, in fact, it was not the suggestion of Darwin that man was an animal that ruffled the feathers of Christians at the time, but it was, moreover, the naturalistic implications of Darwinism, not the animalistic implications of Darwinism. Specifically, it was the implication that man's or human nature was materialistic, ultimately materially based, and secondly, that it was deterministic, that there was no human freedom that got the goat of Christians. However, I want to suggest three shortcomings with these arguments with Darwin. The first one is that those problems, the materialistic and the deterministic problems, really have intrinsically nothing to do with the relationship of Christianity to science at all, because those are essentially internal theological debates which existed far before Darwin, and in fact far before the scientific revolution. If you look at the deterministic controversy, for example, we can go back hundreds of years before Darwin and look at the battle between Erasmus and Martin Luther on the bondage of the will, and later on the battles between Calvinists and Arminians and Wesleyans and Reformed theology, all kind of taking jabs at one another on essentially the issue of materialism, determinism. Also, the issue of materialism, there doesn't seem to be much theological consensus on that as people contrast Old Testament and New Testament views or Hebrew and Greek views of the dualistic versus monistic nature of man. So I want to suggest first that these controversies which we seem to extract from Darwin are in fact not scientific implications at all, but essentially intra-house theological infighting. And even if we allow for the fact that they may be scientific, I want to suggest that they're not uniquely biological. That uniformitarian geology, and before that Newtonian physics, if you read Gillespie's Genesis and Geology, precipitated the same kinds of questions. So they're not uniquely biological. And finally, even if we assent to the fact and say somehow they are biological, I want to say they're not uniquely Darwinian. In fact, they're not Darwinian at all. In all of his writings, Darwin never came down on, never declared himself on the issue of either materialism or determinism. He never did. And if you look at his personal communication, you find out that this wasn't by accident. He considered both of these issues to be red herrings in terms of the true intellectual import of his theories, so he refused to declare himself. Now, we might say, yeah, he didn't declare himself, but we know where he stood, and that came through in his theories. But in fact, we don't know where he stood because he didn't know where he stood. And those few journal entries in which he shares what he was thinking about the issues of theism, materialism, and determinism, he clearly acknowledges unclarity. He was an agnostic till the day he died on all three of these issues. So to get back to David Meyer's talk from yesterday, I wonder if in our preoccupation with Darwinian materialism and Darwinian determinism, we're in a sense playing the tape backwards or reading Darwin backwards and obscuring the true theological import of Darwin's theory, which might be this. According to sociobiologists of today and according to Darwin himself, he wasn't interested in devising some kind of anthropological metaphysics. That is to say, what is human nature ultimately made of? Is it ultimately autonomous or free? But he was more interested in devising an anthropological natural history. That is to say, what kind of human nature, what kind of natures do we have, and what are specifically the biological forces that constrain human nature, that influence, although not necessarily determine, its development and its expression. And that's what sociobiology is all about. Sociobiology is the attempt to understand the development and the expression via behavior of human nature in the context of Darwinian natural selection theory. So, section number two, I want to just briefly give you three important principles of sociobiology and then see where they lead us theologically. Principle number one is that all animal behavior and all human behavior is facilitated by biology. Now, I chose my word facilitated there carefully. I won't say is determined biology because it's clearly not. But it is all facilitated by biology. To use David Meyer's little example from yesterday, mind emerges from brain. Now, in an effort to be sensitive to those, and if Buswell were here, he might be one, those who want to reserve for themselves the freedom to say, no, mind doesn't emerge from brain, mind emerges from spirit. And that's non-material, supernatural. I'd even be willing to change the word, the preposition from, to through. Mind emerges through brain. The biologist ultimately is not concerned, again, with the metaphysical question of where things come from, but they're concerned with the processes which mediate the observable phenomenon. So mind emerges through brain, and wherever it comes from, what we do, who we are, what we think, all has to, the bottleneck is biology. We cannot do something which our biology does not enable us to do. And to be crass, since 1953, we've been rather firmly convinced that all biology comes from genes. And so, therefore, all human behavior has to be facilitated, has to emerge or enabled by genes. Not determined, but at least enabled. Principle number two of sociobiology is that genes themselves develop, but more importantly, persist in species through the process of natural selection. Now, I don't want to get into the intricacies of natural selection except to say this. It's a very simple concept, but unfortunately not well understood by even a lot of biologists. It can be simply defined as the differential reproduction of genotypes. That is to say that genotypes reproduce non-randomly, differentially, with respect to the phenotypes or qualities that they produce. I have students in my classes, some of them claim that I give grades randomly with respect to how much they've learned in my class. But Darwin says in natural selection that the grade nature gives, that is to say reproductive success, is not random with respect to the phenotype or the adaptive character of the organisms. So, as a result of principle number two, we would have to conclude that any genes in a population, if they persist in the population, have to confer reproductive success to the individual. If they don't, they simply won't be there. And then neither of these first two premises are particularly striking, but now we get to principle number three, which has some interesting implications. If all behaviors come from biology or genes, and all genes are there because they confer reproductive success, therefore, all behaviors which are biologically based, that's a key, because not all behaviors are biologically based, but all behaviors which accrue from broadly based biological inclinations to do something or aversions not to do something, all of those behaviors have to contribute to reproductive success. Now that raises the critical theoretical dilemma of sociobiology. Now E.O. Wilson, the deviser of the name sociobiology, but by no means the theme of sociobiology, recognizes this as the critical theoretical dilemma. Even his detractors, Stephen Jay Gould, for example, who criticizes genetic determinism, say that he's been very sharp in distinguishing this, and I haven't told you what this is yet, as the central theoretical issue of sociobiology, although really it's not so insightful, because 100 years ago, Darwin himself said that his study would hinge, stand or fall on this particular issue, and that is this. If all behaviors have to contribute to reproductive success, then by natural selection, we cannot have the development of a behavior which involves the sacrificing of reproductive success. That can't exist. And that's what biologists or sociobiologists call genetic altruism. Now, I don't want to confuse this with some kind of psychological altruism where you gush with sentiment and the desire to help somebody. Biologist is very operational in terms of his discerning the existence of altruism or not, and he simply asked the question, not what do you feel, not what do you desire, not what you intend, but what do you do? Do you sacrifice your reproductive success for someone else's? If you do, that's genetic altruism. But if that behavior exists, it cannot have originated by natural selection. In fact, the sociobiologist in Darwin himself said, if we can find that behavior existing in large scale across the animal kingdom, throw out my theory, because there's no way my theory can explain the origin of such behavior. The problem is there are many behaviors which appear to be genetically altruistic. Organisms frequently give their lives for one another. What about these things? Well, sociobiologists have studied just about every example that has been observed of apparent genetic altruism, and they've lumped them into one of two categories. The first category is what sociobiologists call kin selection. They say it's not really altruistic at all. When a parent gives his or her life for an offspring, that offspring is carrying the genes of the parent. So, in fact, the parent is not sacrificing his or her reproductive success. In giving his or her life, the parent is ensuring reproductive success. And W.D. Hamilton has, in fact, mathematically modeled the extent to which we would expect to see what he calls kin selection in the animal kingdom. And it's proportional to, on the one hand, the degree of curtailment of future reproduction that exists, and on the other hand, the degree of genetic relatedness that exists between the organisms exchanging sacrifice. So about 50 years ago, one of C.S. Lewis's big nemesis, J.B.S. Haldane, was sitting in an English pub once, doodling on the back of a napkin, and he finally popped up and said, "I'll give my life for two brothers or eight cousins." And it's kind of the essence of what Hamilton, although he's taken it much farther, means by kin selection. You give your life, and the extent to which you're willing to sacrifice for kin is related to the amount of genetic investment you have in those individuals. Now, there are a lot of very interesting permutations of this theory, which we don't have time to go into. For example, you ought to be more willing to sacrifice for genetically related individuals if you are more certain that you're related to those individuals. So that parents are usually more willing to sacrifice than siblings, because siblings aren't necessarily sure they came from the same parent. Within the animal kingdom, parents who know that their offspring were theirs, for example, mammals and birds, because they either bear their young or tend their eggs, are more willing to sacrifice than animals who don't know. For example, fish and amphibians, whose eggs oftentimes are fertilized and developed externally, and they don't know whose are whose. Within the mammals, females are usually more willing to sacrifice than males, because females are more sure that their offspring are theirs than males are. There are lots of other examples like this. Many of them are genuine predictions of sociobiological theory and not just a posteriori explanations of what was already known. I want to throw out one more example, real interesting example of a prediction made by Robert Trivers several years ago. And this was a problem that really puzzled Darwin. It was a problem of the hymenoptera. How can you have entire castes of organisms who not only are willing to risk death, but in fact willing to genetically forego the privilege of reproducing all their lives? They're genetically sterile castes of organisms, ants, bees, and wasps. How on earth can you have that? Isn't that altruistic behavior? And the solution to that is a real ingenious one. Those and only those organisms are not like you and I are. They're not diploid organisms. They're not organisms that have two sets of chromosomes, but they have a unique genetic system called haplodiploidy, where the females have two sets of chromosomes, the males have one, and I won't go into the details of that, except to say that it turns out that in that situation, siblings are not related, don't share half their genes with one another, as you do with your siblings if you're not an only child, but in fact they have a 75% or three-quarter genetic relationship with one another. So it turns out that they're actually better off tending their siblings than they are having their own children if all they care about, which natural selection says is the case, if all they care about is making sure their genes get into the next generation. However, because of the unique condition of haplodiploidy, they're 75% related if they're sister-sister. They're only 25% related if they're sister-brother. So there's kind of a contest here. The queen would like to see equal amounts of males and females because she shares equal genetic investment in them all, but the workers, who are females, would like to see more females than males. And what Trivers did was he went out and looked at 19 species of different species of Hymenoptera. And he saw that in every single species, when he looked at attending or provisionary behavior amongst workers, they gave three times more food to females than they did to males, 75 to 25, exactly the ratio of genetic investment they had. But in one species, which was taken as slaves by another species of ant, and therefore when they were attending in the nurseries and had no genetic investment, they deviated from the 3-to-1 and they just gave food randomly. If they escaped and got back to their own hive where they did have genetic investment, they went back to the 3-to-1 ratio. Again, that's a prediction and not a postdiction of sociobiological theory. Well, you say, how about situations in which we aren't related to the individual? I mean, that happens all the time. Birds, for example, give warning calls in flocks, and the bird who gives the call increases his risk of getting eaten by the predator by virtue of his increased visibility. Robert Trivers and Richard Dawkins have described this kind of behavior not as kin selection but as reciprocal altruism, and they've modeled it mathematically and demonstrated, in fact, that those behaviors as well do not result in a reduction in fitness or a reduction in reproductive success, that those behaviors only occur in socially gregarious animals where, in fact, they can expect the same kind of behavior in return from that social group. So, again, the models become very complex, and for those of you who are familiar with the game Prisoner's Dilemma, where the best way to get out of the prisoner is to plan an escape and cheat on the guy you're going with second best is for you to both help one another, third best is for you to not help him but get caught, etc. There are all sorts of coefficients of successfulness that can be put into mathematical models that do in fact predict what actually happens in socially gregarious organisms. But the bottom line is, as of yet, we haven't found a single apparently altruistic behavior that actually results in a reduction in fitness. They're all either kin selection or reciprocal altruism. So at this point, we could paraphrase the golden rule and say, do unto others as they would have you do unto them. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, if the others are either related to you or in your immediate social group. If they're not, do to others before they do it to you. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is a moral way to go about things. In fact, this is where I want to briefly get into the last section of the talk. What are the moral implications of this theory? Number one, I want to just very quickly say we need to be careful about talking about moral implications. And a lot of people have done kind of biological moralizing. That's extraordinarily dangerous and also fairly naive. Because, in fact, remember, we're having an operational definition of altruism here and not a motivational definition. So the key ingredient of morality, a genuinely Christian morality, which is intentionality, is completely absent from these theories altogether. However, there are two generally ethical implications or anthropological ethical implications of sociobiology. The first is this. I think it negates what up until this point has emerged from ethologists or biological students of animal behavior as what I would call a kind of a fatalistic primalism, this view that human beings are essentially, at their nature, carnivorous, aggressive, animalistic, territorial, imperative beings, as Freud claimed. In fact, this view exists since Freud, and as he claimed in Civilization and Its Discontents, the only value and function of culture is to somehow repress these aggressive animalistic instincts. And more recent popularizations of this view can be found in the works of Desmond Morris and The Naked Ape, or Conrad Lorenz, or Robert Audrey. The sociobiologists are saying, no, there may be intrinsic animal aggression to human beings, but there is also intrinsic cooperativity. Now, that cooperativity is also there in other animals, so that's a little bit humbling. But no to fatalistic primalism. But although there's an upside, there's also a downside, and here's where I want to end up. It seems to me that sociobiology says that if we follow the default inclinations of our biological instincts, which aren't all bad, they're only going to take us so far. They're only going to take us to exercise empathy or cooperativity with relatives or friends, as it were. And the message of Jesus, it seems to me, and here's where I may get nailed, but nevertheless, the message of Jesus, I think, stands in stark contrast to that. One of the things that Jesus did was radically challenge prevailing notions of kinship and social identification. He raises the question, who proved neighbor to him? That is to say, not who did society determine was a neighbor, but we have a choice there. He raises the question, who are my mother, my brother, my sister, my father, those who hear and do the will of God? And lest that not be enough, he then went on to concrete examples. And he said to the Pharisees, even you, being evil, know how to give good things to your children. Now, that's not saying that a parent providing for his children is bad, but he was saying that you could be thoroughly evil yourself and still, by virtue of common grace, of socio-biological impetus, do good to your children. And finally, he says this, these familiar passages, if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Don't even the Gentiles do the same? And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And then he closes, of course, with the golden rule, the real golden rule. Therefore, whatever you want others to do for you, do so for them. For this is the law and the prophets. Okay.